Honoured guests, alumni, colleagues, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this particular session in Melbourne University's Festival of Ideas on food fights and food security. My name is Graham Mitchell. I'm your chairman this afternoon. Before we get into things, I would just like to remind you of three things. The first is that the session, including the Q&A, questions and answers at the end of our session, they're being filmed and audio recorded. Secondly, to remind you, if you've not already done it, to turn off your mobile phones, much appreciated. And then thirdly, a little bit about the format. What we will do, we'll have three 15 to 20 minute presentations, then a little discussion, a dialogue amongst the panel when they've heard what each other's said, leaving half an hour, if not more, for discussion. And I think the size of the audience bespeaks the interest in this particular topic. And so there will be a vigorous question and answer. We must leave plenty of time for that. So as our panellists, we have very fortunate to have three eminent speakers, three genuine ideas people, all professors of the University of Melbourne, Janet McCalman, Snow Barlow, and Tim Reeves. Now, those of you who have been following the climate change debate will, I suggest, have not yet heard a lot or seen a lot of coverage on what some of us believe is a very major looming threat to human well-being, social order, and world peace, namely food security. If you go out and survey people and say, what is the most important thing for you day by day, and say, don't answer now, come back in 2 weeks and answer that question, you will see a very high proportion of people will say an assured supply of safe food. So food is obviously important to us. And we'll hear from our panellists some of the pretty stark arithmetic around this issue of global food security, certain figures, trends and data sets which provide a very clear wake-up call. So it's a very timely symposium, and I congratulate the organisers of the Festival of Ideas of picking this particular one, and especially the three people who are going to be talking to us about that problem. And you'll also hear from those panellists of some options to address and solve these particular issues swirling around food security. We do pride ourselves, as you know, as being the clever species on this earth. And we've had wicked problems. We've confronted them in the past. What can we do about this one? And I think food security, like climate change, is a wicked problem in that it's going to be insidious, it's going to creep up on us, and it will have major implications in this heavily populated world with very finite resources. So we need to prepare ourselves, again, using that classic approach of a technological fix plus a major practice change. So without further ado, it's now my pleasure to introduce the first of our panellists. Now, you will have had, or will have, the biographies and CVs of these folk. So with their permission, I will do give them short shrift in terms of their eminent credentials and just simply say the first about Professor Janet McCalman, as best known for three prize-winning histories of Melbourne life, as well as a former long-running column in the Age newspaper. She holds a joint appointment in the Faculty of Medicine, Dentistry and Health Sciences and the Faculty of Arts in this university, and teaches the new interdisciplinary university breadth subject, an ecological history of humanity. And Janet, quite appropriately, is going to kick off with a bit of a historical perspective on food production, food supply, and the consequences of shortages. Professor Janet McCalman.
Thank you, Graham. Now, this was no, the wrong one. To the genius of love and the genius of hunger, Turgenev might well have added the weather. For all species, the purpose of life itself is to find sustenance to be able to reproduce a viable next generation. But climate has always determined where and when that was possible. As Australians, we have perhaps a greater appreciation of the deep prehistory of humanity than people of any continent other than Africa. People have lived in Australia continuously for around 60,000 years, and the demographer Len Smith, who's come today, has calculated that this dry, ancient portion of the earth has supported around 1 billion human lives past infancy, scarcely an unproductive terra nullius. But in much of Europe and all the Americas, continuous human occupation and history go back only to the beginning of the Holocene, 10 to 12,000 years ago. There were up to 7 attempts by humans and their ancestors to colonize Britain, for instance, and each suffered extinction because of extreme climate change. In fact, human history, as opposed to prehistory, can only have said to have begun in the Holocene. And if you look at the record of variability of human temperatures, you can see why. For most of the world, human history is crammed into that relatively short time since the end of the last ice age. This list begins with the domestication of plants and animals, the intensification of food production, the building of complex sedentary societies, where the soil sources, food sources, climate, soils and water made that possible, the expansion of political and economic power into peripheral empires to support the core, and the development of science and technology to conquer space, time, and ecological constraints on energy. It is only 9,000 years since the first city, Katahu, in Turkey, 5,000 years since the first great civilizations of the Mediterranean, 1,500 years since the decline of the Roman Empire, 1,000 years since the medieval warm period, 500 years from the beginning of the Columbian Exchange, 200 years since the Aboriginal people of this land lost their freedom and their world. And it's just 200 years since the emergence of the fossil economy that has transformed our lives, both for great good and now increasingly for ill. And for most of our long prehistory and history, the lot of humankind has been hunger. Foragers kept hunger at bay with their encyclopedic knowledge of plants, animals, water, and the seasons, but they had to travel light so that they could move with the seasonal flow and ebb of resources. That meant they also had to control the other genius of all living things, love. New babies could only be raised if there was no other child to carry, so that why high infant mortality and infanticide have been a grim constant in our human story, fertility was often managed by extended lactation. But once humans found ways to produce and husband food in one place, rather than simply find it, women's work in field and household made extended breastfeeding more difficult and early weaning much easier. Infant mortality rose, and with higher infant mortality came higher fertility. Human beings now needed to maximise their fertility, to invest, if you like, in redundancy, to maintain their numbers. We know from the archaeological evidence that civilization or complex societies made their inhabitants shorter, sicker, and more often acquainted with death. The normal lot of parents came to be that they buried their children, sometimes nearly all of them. And that did not change even in this country and its heritage societies until the beginning of the 20th century. The history of humanity, therefore, has also been one of a biological contest between love and hunger that has been at the mercy of the weather. It's also been a contest between human groups, not just tribes, states and nations, but even more within groups, between generations and between elites and the masses. Complex food production required human labour, but economies that could produce surpluses found themselves as supporting elites of rulers, priests, bureaucrats and warriors. The control of hunger depended not just on production of food, but critically on the politics of resource distribution in the society. This was a hunger that was dependent not simply on the weather, the ecological conditions of production, but on the social organisation and the society's values. This was a hunger that the Nobel Prize-winning economist Amartya Sen has identified as entitlement, and in complex societies, an individual's entitlement, either by lineage or status, material wealth, intellectual capital or work determined their share of wealth and therefore sustenance. This too was in a way about love, a different sort of love, social love, the relationships between people and the way they value others. The history of human hunger, therefore, is both ecological and political. But driving it all were the natural systems of the climate. Even the Holocene has experienced variations in climate that have profoundly affected where and how well human communities have been able to live. What's more, the variations over the past 5,000 years have been comparatively small in their range of mean temperature compared to the Pleistocene, and comparatively small compared to the changes in temperature which are now being predicted in our own time. But the effects have been severe. So no matter going back to the historical record and pretending climate variation is normal and benign, it has certainly not been in our recorded history. The world may seem big and robust, but we're coming to appreciate how fragile is the balance between survival and catastrophe, between life and death. The elephant in the room in this history of the Holocene is Eurasia, the home of the handful of mammals and cereal plants that could be domesticated. If history has seemed Eurasia-centric, it is because, in the terms of intensification of human population, it was, until very recent times, the big winner. By the year one, after 6,000 years of comparative climatic calm, the world's population was distributed thus. This is a morphed map from the Sheffield University Department of Geography. The regions that sustain most human life were China, India, and the Mediterranean system of Roman hegemony, including Egypt, Northwest Africa, plus Northwest Africa and the Bantu farmers. These were peoples who had intensified production of cereals, often by irrigation. They had beasts of burden to pull ploughs. They had horses for warfare and roaming the steppes. They had animals for protein and hides. They had ships for trade to bring grain to settlements that could not provide for themselves. Deeper into Europe, the great rivers provided lifelines of trade. Already by this time, the fertile crescent of Mesopotamia had dried out and declined into underpopulation and poverty. On the other hand, the Americas, as you see, were tiny in demographic terms, showing significant human impact only in Mesoamerica and in Peru. If we look at the world's wealth at the beginning of the Christian era, we can see that wealth and population were symbiotically linked. 1,500 years on the eve of the Columbian Exchange of species, 1,500 years later, on the eve of the Columbian Exchange of species, natural resources, and people across the Atlantic, the distribution of the world's people had changed very little. Humankind was still locked into the Eurasian landmass, and Japan had grown, as had France and Britain. Italy had diminished a little. Northwest Africa had grown, with city-states enriched by trade across the Sahara, and in America, the Aztec and Inca empires had produced growth. But North America had not grown proportionately. If you look at the world's wealth at the same time, 1500, you can see that wealth and population size were still interdependent. Some places like Italy, however, enriched by its maritime economy, were wealthy beyond their population size, and as you can see, England was still a midget power. However, there's another map that measures the untapped organic potential of the world, that of current biocapacity, and that includes cropland, pasture, forests, and fisheries. 16% of the world's biocapacity is in Brazil. But a huge proportion of it, equal to China's and Europe, and greater than India's, is just in the United States alone. Biocapacity can be read as the potential of the world as an organic economy. Yet in 1500, the vast biocapacity of America's remained untapped. We now appreciate that this imbalance was not due to the superior cognitive capacity of Eurasian people. It depended entirely on having domesticated animals as beasts of burden and for food and as food and textiles. Farmers with just a hoe, compared to those with a bullock and a plough, produced very much less. They also grew less tall if they had little animal protein to eat, as happened in Mesoamerica and West Africa. Most significant, perhaps, of all, the Highlanders of New Guinea, who were amongst the world's first farmers 9,000 years ago, remained locked into malnutrition and subsistence living by their lack of rich resources of plant and animal protein from the natural environment, either for forager hunting or cultivation and husbandry. There were whole societies, therefore, that were forever hungry. It was historical geographers and economic historians who began directing attention to the concept of an organic economy. It was powered by solar energy that was transferred via biomass to fire and heat and to the muscles of beasts of burden, slaves, serfs and peasants. Food production and its adequacy to meet the needs of the population is entirely dependent on climate, soil, water and social organisation. Therefore, variations in climate that affected agricultural productivity have always driven the deep history of the world. Likewise, timber, peat and cattle dung were the most important combustible fuels for cooking, heating, metal and woodworking, pottery and brickmaking. Consequently, the availability of trees determined how well a people kept warm and cooked, built houses and boats that might enable them to trade and make up for the deficiencies in their own ecology. If, like the Romans, they had built a society of such density and complexity that the hinterlands could not supply sufficient grain, then they needed the ships to bring that grain from afar. The Roman fleet supplying grain into the Italian peninsula from the granaries of North Africa would not be matched in size until those of 17th century England. The economy of renewable energy might have been ecologically sound, but it was never productive enough to keep up with the demands of human population growth. The first person to really understand that was the Reverend Thomas Malthus, whose essay on population in 1798 argued that while the productivity of the managed natural world could only grow arithmetically, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, the human population, if unchecked by restraints on births or by deaths on mortality crises, grew geometrically, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32. What has become known as the Malthusian trap was an economy where human populations were constantly outgrowing their ecologies and the resulting famines and epidemic diseases so checked population in a so-called positive way. If human beings were not to experience... If human beings were not to experience the misery of losing their children and loved ones too soon, they had to constrain their reproduction, Malthus argued, by sexual restraint. The controversial economic historian Gregory Clark has represented the history of the world caught in the Malthusian trap thus, and you can see at the bottom of the page. The rises and falls represent the fluctuations of the climate from the warm period of the Roman Empire, the cooling that underwrote its decline, the warming from the early to high Middle Ages where European agricultural productivity funded the glories of Gothic cathedrals, the founding of the universities and the great abbeys, and the astonishing growth in towns after centuries of urban poverty and disease. Europeans, however, were pushing to the boundaries of arable land and consuming the forests. Then the weather turned wet and cold. The crops failed. Famine savaged Europe before the Mongols, fleeing inland droughts of the medieval warming, helped to communicate the Black Death east and west. This was the calamitous 14th century. And after that, the background to the glorious period of human European painting, writing and thought, and to the growth of commerce and industry was urban affluence and rural decline. Florence, in the 420 years between 1371 and 1791, had only 16 very good harvests, fewer than four a century. Indeed, Florence had been dependent on Sicilian grain since the 13th century. Feudalism was an inefficient agricultural system, and Europe's agriculture needed to consolidate holdings and privatise commons for it to begin to produce adequate surpluses. But land consolidation, when it came, left peasants landless and without access to commons, adding to the growing army of vagabonds, beggars, and landless people. Towns and cities could import food and timber from elsewhere and build mercantile wealth. But as the hinterlands went into decline, towns found themselves besieged by the hungry and homeless. Put into simplest terms, European agriculture could not generate sufficient calories in food for the masses to power its economy from within its own resources. However, as Europe got colder after 1500, it also got richer. As the Little Ice Age wore on, towns also suffered from the growing shortage of that other staple of the organic economy, timber, particularly for the building of ships that linked seaports to the world system. Europe found the biocapacity, however, to keep pace with the wealth-creating needs of its elites elsewhere. If we look at where the world's wealth lay by 1900, we can see again who were the winners and losers in the 400 years since the Columbian Exchange between the New World and the Old across the Atlantic had begun. By 1900, the Americas, and particularly the United States, had entered the world story. But the critical impact of the New World was the explosion of wealth in Western Europe, especially in Great Britain, Belgium and France, the decline of the Iberians, the utter depletion of Africa, the shrinking of China and India. The great economic historian of China, Kenneth Pomerantz, has called Europe's enrichment the Great Divergence. His analysis begins with the premise that even as late as the early 19th century, China and India were still on a par with Europe as economic powers. The Great Divergence came from Europe's capacity to draw on timber and biocapacity in the New World, using free labour from Africa and on coal. First, that biocapacity that created the new wealth from Europe came from the organic economy using human energy from Africa. And the African historian Joseph Inokori has mapped the dire effect of the slave trade on the human and capital and resources of West Africa in particular. Africa was always, until our own time, an underpopulated continent. And Africa's irony and tragedy is that the major export of this chronically underpopulated continent has been in human beings. The Atlantic Triangle saw African human energy transported to the tropical Americas, where at the cost of subsistence only, it converted New World biocapacity into vast financial wealth for West Europeans via sugar, cotton and coffee. That wealth in turn provided the British elite with the investment capital that was available when they took the next critical step, the move to the fossil economy. The Cambridge economic historian Sir Anthony Wrigley has reminded us what Malthus could not anticipate was the impact of the fossil economy. Tapping into carbon trapped and stored in a combustible form during deep historical time enabled humanity to short-circuit geological time. This way, we escape the natural time limits of the organic economy. The transformation of capacity by this new energy was as revolutionary and, of course, much quicker than the capture of animal energy from domestication and forced human labour. Britain could now be rebuilt in brick rather than wood or stone, because no longer did the forests have to be sacrificed to bake the bricks. Likewise, glass and windows now became affordable. With the production of 10,000 tonnes of iron required the felling of 100,000 acres of woodland, there were severe limits on the making of quality iron and steel. The other European country to take this path simultaneously was Belgium, but not the Netherlands, which relied on peat. The puzzle of why China did not has been the question that's preoccupied many historians since, but essentially to do with their lack of access to the right sort of financial operations. Liberated from the constraints of the organic economy, human population growth was limited now only by disease, institutionalised inequality and violence. The Nobel Prize winner Robert Fogel argues that the most remarkable achievement of the 20th century was the extension of life expectancy, which increased by about 30 years since 1900 in England, France, the United States and equal larger amounts elsewhere. The transformation of energy from organic to fossil led to exponential growth in material wealth and technologies that combined with human culture to create what he called techno-physico-evolution. This growth of human population has overwhelmingly, though, been since 1950. But like the Little Ice Age, it has been in cities while the countryside has been reformed and consolidated where possible into agribusinesses. The great subsistence peasant economies of Africa and India are being replaced by modern farming that produces export crops but displaces small farmers. The supply of calories has kept pace with population growth until the present, but a consequence has been the destruction of rural societies in India and Africa, leaving people to seek survival in the great slums of the modern world. Mike Davis has called our world a planet of slums, where now more than half humanity lives in cities, most of them outside Europe, in mega metropolises of misery. Most of all, the fossil economy has enabled us to escape the Malthusian trap, but it is only a temporary escape. The world still has limits to growth if we depend on non-renewables that are finite resources. And as we are now aware, in cheating nature by short-circuiting geological time, we have imported the carbon of the dead past into the living world of the present and the future, where it has disturbed our atmospheric equilibrium. We are now paying a fearful price. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Janet. Very thoughtful. Professor Snow Barlow is a plant physiologist and agricultural scientist who has published more than 100 papers in environmental plant biology on plant water use, efficiency, viticulture, and impacts of climate change, including elevated CO2 levels on agricultural industries. Snow is the Foundation Professor of Horticulture and Viticulture and Associate Dean in brackets Strategic Relationships at the University of Melbourne. And Snow will outline some of the current challenges in this food security arena and discuss what we've actually got in the science and technology armamentarium. What's in our kit bag to actually address some of these mega issues? Snow Barlow.
Thank you, Graham, and alumni and friends and colleagues. Janet has taken us on a fantastic journey through the history of time. But I'm going to bring you down to earth and remind you that we are, as Homo sapiens, are but one of millions of species on Earth. And our continued survival and our evolution on this Earth will depend on what it all depends on all other species. Basically, can we feed ourselves enough to reproduce? Can we avoid disease? And can we avoid being eaten? Today I'm going to argue that we are sitting on a food security time bomb through a perfect storm of a number of international pressures that are developing. I'm going to argue further that climate change exacerbates this threat to our food security. Then consider, in the more positive way, how we might adapt to that. Do we have any science in the cupboard? Is there ways that we could apply science and technology to this, but in a social context? And finally, finish with a plea to say that our global resources are finite, and any solution that we come to food security inevitably has to be a solution about energy, food, and water security. But I want to begin today with a little story that I think gives you a metaphor to think about this in. There was a fantastic story, true of course, out of country Victoria more than a month ago, of a country GP who, confronted with an enormous problem, he had a child who'd fallen off a skateboard, hit his head, and had all the symptoms of brain hemorrhaging, pressure developing in his cranial cavity. He was at a country hospital. There was no neurosurgeon. There was no possibility of neurosurgery. To put the person on a plane would have been absolute death because of the increased pressure, or increased pressure in the brain. So what did he do? He used modern technology. He got his mobile phone. He contacted in Melbourne an internationally renowned neurosurgeon. He confirmed the diagnosis. He was given what the treatment was. The treatment was to release the pressure with a surgical drill. It's the only problem, no surgical drill at a country hospital. But he did know Joe the carpenter, and he knew that he had a cordless drill. So he got a cordless drill, but with a mobile phone in one hand and a cordless drill in the other, adequately sterilised. He relieved the pressure. The boy survived, and survived very healthily. That metaphor is, we have an enormous pressure building up on the globe in a sense of people, in a sense of demand for resources. We need to apply the best technology we have available to that. But we need to apply it in a local context, because ultimately that's where the food will be produced. If I can make this thing work now. Yeah, sorry, overshoot. Yep. The basis to this equation is the land versus food. We know now that this is perhaps our planet, but our only planet. And every time we put in another human being on this globe, we actually decrease the amount of land available for the growth of food for that individual. As we move to 2050, put that as a target, we expect 3 billion more people on this globe. Almost exclusively, as Janet hinted at, they will be in urban societies. The odd global financial crisis aside, they will be wealthier. And as they are wealthier, they will want to change their diets, include more animal protein in their diet. An animal protein is an expensive way to live. It might make you grow taller, as it's happening in the Asian societies now, but if you want to eat animal protein, it'll cost you somewhere between 2 and 8 times what it does for plant protein. In other words, if you grow a chicken, it's twice, grow a cow, 8 times. So that's one pressure. The second pressure is this, the love affair of modern societies with the automobile and the need for developed nations, so-called developed nations, to secure liquid fuels through the production of biofuels at the expense of food, using the same land that might have provided food to supply biofuels. Another pressure. So with that, we need at a minimum of 50% more food and probably 70 to 80% more food by 2050. That is the equation. Already the globe is responding. Since Roman times, food security has been measured in days of grain in the granary. The Green Revolution took that problem in the 60s, leading to, in the 80s and the up to the 90s, a sufficiency of grain where we moved the amount of grain and the number of days of world supplies in the world's granaries from 50 to over 100 days. You'll notice after the 2000, there has been a decline, and we are now back to 50 days from those pressures I just described to you. You'll also know there have been food riots around the world. That was perhaps a blip in that, but 50 days is living on the edge. So, where are we going to go, and what resources do we have? I don't know what resources I have here. There we go. Oh, somehow I lost something there. Oh, well, don't worry, these are just background. If you add up the demands for food in the way us agriculturalists do, for human food, for animal food, animal protein, and more latterly, biofuel, you get a number that tells you that you need, demand is increasing. It was increasing in the 70s by 1.5% per annum. In the 80s, it was 1.6. In the 90s, it was 1.9. Post-2000, because of the advent of mandated biofuel targets, it is now 2.6, which means that we need to grow 2.6% more food with every year. And with the current projections we have, we've got this target that we need to maintain productivity gains of 2 to 3% until 2050, despite climate change. So, what are the resources we have to do this with? It's not the case as it was in the agricultural revolution of the 19th century. It's not the case of the green revolution of the mid-century of the 20th century. I think we're getting close to resource limits on this globe. Consider one of the key resource limits if you want to grow food, because for every kilogram of food you grow, you need about 1,000 litres of water. So despite someone telling us, Glenn Whitewig telling us, we were very successful this morning at decreasing our water production in Melbourne down to 155 a day, Glenn, as much as I love him, was not telling you the full amount. You actually need 6,000 litres because you've got to eat. And that's what it takes to feed someone on an Australian-American diet, 5,000 to 6,000 litres a day. So, what shape are the world's great irrigation areas, great production areas? The red across the slide behind you, you can see that many of the great food bowls of the world, North China Plain, India, Pakistan, some of the Middle East, not a great food bowl, but United States, southwestern United States, and of course our own Murray-Darling Basin, are already water-stressed. Last week I was in Beijing, and we, with a joint seminar with the Chinese Academy of Sciences on water, they have a drought in the North China Plain. The North China Plain is fed by the Yellow River coming from the Tibetan Plateau, for those of you who this morning and heard of the decrease in the availability of water coming from the Tibetan Plateau. But the academician who talked to us left us with a view that China, in the next 30 years, would need another 100 million tonnes of grain. To give you an idea, in a good year, which we hope it is this year in Australia, we produce 30 million tonnes of grain. So that is another challenge. Come down to our own Murray-Darling Basin, just to give you a bit of context. We could go to other catchments around the world and just look at what we're looking at. This is a projection of the inflows into the Murray River under a number of climate scenarios. But the blue line down the bottom represents the average inflow on the mark to the Murray over the last 13 years. This is a drought, we hope, in the last 13 years. But you can't help noticing, though, that where we're running in the current drought is effectively at a 2050 high climate change scenario. And that's what we were told was happening this morning. We weren't told that that was happening in terms of rainfall, but that's our observation at present. So these are the things that we need to be prepared for. It won't necessarily be a slow decline in the temperature and rainfall that we increase in temperature, decrease in rainfall. In some sense, and this is the challenge for the University of Melbourne and Australia as a whole, if it's going to happen anywhere, it's probably good. We are one of the worst nations, Southern Australia, one of the worst hit areas in climate change. But we are a developed nation, and we have one of the best developed R&D systems in the world in agricultural context, and also a way of getting that information to people who are actually farmers. So we can not only help ourselves in this, but we can play a leading role in the globe of determining the pathways forward for climate adaptation, but also the methodologies that you need to plan, because as we mentioned this morning, it's not a top-down approach to climate adaptation. It's actually a bottom-up approach. You have to work with the people on the ground, in order to do this, and Tim will do talk more on this later. Oh, it's freaked out. Can we do it? We've seen water resources may be more limited than they were. Is there some productivity left in the science and left in our global grain stores? Well, I'm just briefly showing here that in that technology and science pathway in the United States, corn yields increased by essentially four times in the 50 years from 1950 to 2000. China got on that pathway about 20 years after that and is now probably up to three times those yields. More recently, Latin America has got on that pathway and is probably up to twice those yields. Sub-Saharan Africa, you know, regrettably, is not on that pathway yet. So there is some pent-up productivity increases to be made on existing science that we have to be applied. What new science do we have? We have great scientists have identified genes that can help us with these stresses that continually plague plant growth and crop growth, namely salinity stress, water stress, and nitrogen stress, because you need nitrogen to grow big crops. So we can identify these genes now, and you will find that we have done an enormous amount. At the time of the beginning of the Green Revolution, if you remember, as a scientist, you will know that we just really discovered DNA. Watson and Crick, 1956. Only in 2004 did we finally sequence the human genome. What will happen in the next decade, and some are almost, well, rice is pretty well there already, we will sequence the major agricultural crops and the major agricultural animals. That doesn't mean we immediately, as it hasn't for human medicine, will unlock enormous productivity increases, but it provides an enormous roadmap that modern plant breeding can utilise to meet these challenges. So there's a lot of new science since 1960. What else is happening? The second thing, which Glenn Whitewing mentioned this morning, is information technology can play a large role in meeting this challenge in really three ways. The first is it's enormously valuable to manage risks in agriculture if you have good mid-season forecasts, and you need to crunch a lot of data. So the advances in climate models and in mid-season forecasts, they haven't been realised yet, but we're hopeful we can do that and decrease a lot of the risks in that way. Secondly, as Glenn mentioned at all, the opportunity to manage in real time from electronic data that is collected around a farm and offers enormous possibilities to how you manage water more efficiently. And we think we can do that. And finally, probably the thing that's going to have the biggest impact, I think, and Tim might comment on this more, the world now has thrown away hard lines and uses mobile phones. The way of communicating both market information, technology, and increasing human capacity in a distributed way offers enormous possibilities, and the humble mobile phone offers that. Now, there is an urgency in this. I wanted to bring you back to Australia for a moment. The urgency is, and David Carroll indicated it this morning, in the interim, as CO2 increases up to a global warming in general terms of 2 degrees, CO2 can actually compensate for decreased rainfall. And the table I show you there, I'm not going to go through it, but just look at the red bits. If you don't stabilise CO2 at less than 550, you end up in dangerous climate change. And dangerous climate change for Australia, and this is Australia, this is around the Australian wheat belt, means that you get into the red because temperatures are just too high to adapt and rainfall is probably too low, and no matter how much CO2 you had, you couldn't do it. So you need, one, we need mitigation action internationally, but two, we need to harness our agricultural resources to use this window of opportunity. Does investment help in this? We found out from the Green Revolution that investment in agricultural research yields very handsome gains. And we found out that if you invest wisely, there are strong returns to those investments. But the world was awash with grain by the time it got to 1990, and we stopped investing. And those yield increases tailed off, and that's where they still are, and Tim has more detailed data on that. So there is a strong case for investment in R&D in this. And we know that, one, you get good returns, but two, there are strong social returns. So if you invest in R&D in Australia, there will be spillover effects all around the world. So globally, because of those social or spillover effects in economic terms, are found around the world through investment in one particular place. And finally, the solution to this is with Darwin. Darwin told us that it wasn't the largest or the fastest or the most intelligent species that survived. It was actually the one that adapted fastest. And we are in an adaptive situation. We are in a situation where we not only have to adapt our food systems, but those food systems must adapt in the context of our energy systems and in our context of our water systems. So it's the adaption of the systems, not just the production of food. And to give you an indication of that, what we don't want to do, because agricultural greenhouse emissions globally are directly 15%, deforestation, which is largely for new agricultural land, is another 10%. And if you count the energy that is used in the production of food, it's probably about another 10%. So a third of the world's emissions come from agriculture. Somehow, in this systemic equation that we're looking at, we have to find a way to adapt and increase our food production, but not create a solution that leads to greater climate change through more greenhouse gas emissions. It's a challenging task. It's a task I hope the globe's up to. And bringing it back to the University of Melbourne, I think the University of Melbourne needs to play a large role in this. We have enormous capacity, and the nation in Australia, across other universities in Australia, other research institutions, have tremendous capacity to contribute to what might be global solutions that start with local solutions here. And finally, to quote Vice-Chancellor Glyn Davis, Glyn always says, a decision delayed is a decision made. We need to make a decision now. Thank you.
Thank you, Snow. Also very thought-provoking, and going to continue that theme of the arithmetic around global food security and how food security can be achieved in the 21st century. It's now Professor Tim Reeves, the third and final speaker in our panel session. Professor Tim Reeves has worked for 40 years in agricultural research, development and extension, focused on sustainable agriculture in Australia and overseas. His professional career includes positions in the Department of Agriculture, Victoria, Foundation Professor of Sustainable Agriculture, Agricultural Production at University of Adelaide, from 1992 to 95, and more particularly the Director General of the International Maize and Wheat Improvement Centre, CIMMYT, based in Mexico between 1995 and 2002. And of course, Snow mentioned the Green Revolution. This was the hotbed of it, sort of CIMMYT. Currently, aside from being a professor in the University of Melbourne, he has his own consultancy firm, which specialises in national and international, as we'll hear in a moment, consulting and agricultural R&D. Professor Tim Reeves.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen. As Graham has said, I've had the privilege of working in many parts of the world. And I've seen that it's a world of great contrasts. You know, those of us who live most of our lives here in Australia, I think sometimes we forget just how fortunate we are. And also I've noted in my travels around the world that it's a world of contrast, but also a world that is under enormous stress. Around 130 people are added to the population of the world per minute of every day. Not all those people are going to need cars, they're not all going to need flat screen TVs, but they all have the expectation and the right of sufficient food and water and shelter to lead productive and worthwhile lives and to know the dignity of hard work. Unfortunately, the reality is rather different. That slide has 850 million people. 850 million people who go to bed each night hungry, who live in abject poverty. Unfortunately, I made that slide about 18 months ago. That figure is now over a billion. Part of that has been caused by the financial crisis that we've gone through. Over a billion people, we've only got 6.8 on the planet, living in abject poverty. Half the world's population lives on $2 or less per day. As I said to you, a world of great contrast indeed. And against that background, I think as citizens of the world, our highest priorities must be around food security and poverty alleviation. We look at food security, as Snow has eloquently outlined, there are a number of factors there. I mean, there are short-term disruptions, and the GFC there, even though these colours are blue and white, and some people that I know that I barrack for Geelong Football Club, that GFC is actually the global financial crisis. It's the worst of the two. It has had a tremendous impact, certainly on short-term investment in many things, and of course in the flow of money out of resources, including the so-called soft resources. But more particularly, I want to draw your attention to the longer term impacts on food security, because we don't understand those, we're not going to be able to move forward. And we have underestimated the longer term impacts on food security, both on the demand side and the supply side. On the demand side, the rapidly growing population, but also, particularly in Asia, growing incomes. More people with more money spend a lot more on food. You've got twice the income, you don't just spend twice as much on food, you might spend five or six times as much on food and want more and different kinds of food. So the demand side, we've underestimated it. But more particularly, we've underestimated the supply side. You know, if you go to just about any country in the world, you know, there's a great belief that food comes from supermarkets. Well, it doesn't. It comes from farms. It comes from farms that are stressed by pests and diseases, and increasingly by climatic extremes and the influences of the weather. And so we have really underestimated what it takes to produce this supply of good, safe and nutritious food from planet Earth. Snow mentioned a number of factors on the supply side, and I just want to pick up one of them. And that we've got more people requiring more food, less land, and perhaps most importantly, and this has been referred to a couple of times already today, less water. The competition for water that is in finite supply, the degradation of some of those water supplies, the increasing demand for water in terms of urbanisation, industrialisation, for environmental purposes. About somewhere around 40 to 45% of global food production comes from irrigated systems. So anything that disrupts the supply of water for those food systems is going to have an enormous effect, not just on those directly living there, but on all of us in terms of global food security. On the demand side, as I said, the tremendous growth we've seen in income and consumption. You can see it here in relation to Asia, 9% per annum in this period between 2004 and 6. But even in Africa, 6% increase. And you'll notice, of course, that the real growth is in the developing and emerging world rather than in the industrialized countries where populations are stabilized, in some cases are declining, and our demands for food are not going up much. India, the projections by 2025, nearly a doubling of meat consumption. 70% increase, nearly a 176% increase in meat consumption, about 70% increase in milk and vegetable consumption, and about a 30% increase in grain consumption. These are tremendous challenges if you just looked at them by themselves. But once you combine the fact that we probably need to go somewhere between, I would say, between 50 and 100% more food with less land and less water and constrained by climate and constrained by energy, if that is not the most complex problem that the world faces up to, I'd hate to hear what it is. One can also say, in relation to this slide here, that if you're an Australian agricultural producer, if you're a farmer in Australia, there are tremendous opportunities there. For the first time in the world, we've got the biggest markets, the biggest growing markets, more people with more incomes, right on our doorstep. 40 or 50 years ago, we used to have to send all our product around the world to Europe. Now we have this huge extra demand for food on our doorstep, and one can see very much, well, and certainly in my vision, an Australasian South American food bowl to feed basically the rest of the world in the Northern Hemisphere. So there are some real opportunities there as well in terms of the agricultural side. But let's go back to this whole question of the global situation. I've only got one busy slide, and this is it. So I'm not going to ask you to look at too much, but this looks at the three most important food crops in the world, maize, wheat, and rice. And what it looks at is what is happening in terms of the increase in their yield around the world. Global food consumption, the demand increases by about 3 to 4% per year. So ideally, if your big food crops were increasing their yield by 3 to 4% per year, at least you'd be holding your ground. But what has happened is that whilst in the sort of the 1967 to 96 period, for maize, for example, we were up around that 3%, 2.5%, 2.8%, etc. Overall, about 2.7%. Overall, about 2.2% for wheat. Overall, about 2% for rice. When we look at what's happened in the last period, from 97 to 2006, most of these have halved or worse. And so our average yield growth rate per annum now, about 1.5% for maize, less than 1% for wheat, less than 1% for rice. The three most important food crops in the world, when food demand's going up by 3 to 4% per year, these are going the other way. Why? Snow has already mentioned it. One of the key hypotheses is a lack of investment in agriculture. It doesn't matter where you go in the world, particularly in the industrialized world, there has been a disinvestment in agriculture significantly, particularly in those aspects of agriculture that are about productivity. So, when we look at the way forward and how are we going to increase productivity in this scenario, there is clearly a need for a revolution in food production. But it's going to be a little bit different to the Green Revolution. The Green Revolution was extremely timely, was extremely valuable at its time. But what we're looking at now for is not necessarily one size fits all. We're talking about sustainable, homegrown green revolution in many countries around the world. It'll have some important principles. It's about adaptation to climate change. It's about getting the win-win. It's about being able to produce more food with less resources. Clearly, new technologies are going to be critical in relation to this. And two of the major underpinning elements of this, and it's happening already in a number of countries of the world, are around sustainable intensification, higher yields, higher production from lesser areas of land with lesser inputs, which means we have to be much more input use efficient, and about conservation agriculture, which is about input use efficiency, but less ploughing and cultivation of our fragile soils around the land, fragile soils around the world, much greater reliance on reduced tillage, on zero tillage systems, on maintaining organic matter in our soils. And these are already being looked at, and there are some tremendous promise there. When one adds to that some of the genetic solutions, new varieties, you can actually be quite optimistic. Snow was talking about a 30% reduction in the do-nothing scenario. I was looking at wheat varieties when I was at CIMMYT that under drought were up to 200 to 300% better than the best varieties that we had at the time. So there's some tremendous promise there in relation to not only new varieties, but new systems. This sustainable intensification, it can happen. It's already happening in places that we're seeing it. It can be expanded, but it needs investment, and it needs investment in technology and in knowledge transfer. More money spent on agricultural and food production systems rather than less. We've already mentioned some of the challenges to this increased productivity around land, around water. And in many parts of the world, this challenge is being exacerbated, no doubt, by climate change. Particularly, we've talked enough about those, I think. I want to mention desertification. It was mentioned this morning. It's a real challenge in many parts of the world, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa. And it's critical that when we're looking at these more marginal areas, it's an integrated approach that we're looking at. That we are still looking at the principles of sustainable intensification, of conservation agriculture. Because these are the things that can help that spiral up if we can get soil fertility to start to spiral up. But in those areas that are intransigent, then we have to be looking at restructuring and not just perpetuating the misery of people living in those areas. There has to be other solutions, social solutions, of being able to move people, of having a safety net, of being able to make sure that we can put those people in areas where we can support them. That really hasn't happened much to date in some cases, with all the best intentions in the world, we've perpetuated some misery. There are challenges, but there are also tremendous opportunities in this agricultural revolution. And one critical one is the production, is the potential to produce ecosystem services for a global community, within a country, for the urban population, for the whole community, around good management of catchments, that results in clean water being available for the broader community, around the opportunities of biomass for biofuel production. Now, this is quite different. We're still talking about it's going to make economic sense to, if we're going to increase the productivity of our food crops, to have it growing on the best soils possible and getting the highest yields possible. That makes economic sense and environmental sense. But on those lands that are not so suited to food production crops, then the opportunities to grow something else that contributes both economically and environmentally. It may well be biomass for second generation biofuel production. On those soils that are less capable, then it may be a return to the native vegetation and the conservation aspects of that, carbon sequestration. So for the first time, farmers have got not just one option about producing food or fibre to get economic returns, but now everything that makes environmental sense will also make economic sense around food, around biomass, around conservation, around carbon sequestration. These are all opportunities that, to me, will at least match the challenges we're talking about in this global equation. There are also opportunities to really add some value around agriculture in many countries of the world, but particularly in developing countries, and to create greater employment from agriculture than that just on the farm, to really add some value. I was in China not so long ago, and in a village in Sichuan province, where it used to be the government noodle mill, and, you know, with all of the things associated with perhaps the inefficiencies of the government noodle mill. The government noodle mill had now been bought by the local group of farmers. They were trading amongst themselves in terms of wheat, noodles, selling, sharing profit. Sometimes it was a bartering system. But the whole productivity of that mill had created employment and better returns for the farmers. Just a small example. Another great example I heard was when I was on the Global Hunger Task Force, and it was in Africa. And it was about school lunch program. Hey, you know, one way you can really put one good meal into children is give them a school lunch. So people have been thinking about that before, and the World Food Program's been buying grain in the US or Canada or Australia and delivering it there. And so I said, well, you know, why don't we produce the food for the school lunch program locally? Why don't we give the incentive to the local farmers instead of, you know, spending that money elsewhere? So there are some tremendous ideas and opportunities going around there. Africa is a special case. We need to do more about Africa because of the unique problems that it has. It needs more money spent. You know, someone said, estimated, that we probably need to spend about an extra $200 billion a year to solve the problems around food security, poverty, and particularly in Africa. You know, how much have we spent on war? How much have we just spent bailing out General Motors? This is all about priorities. It's not about there's not enough resources or money there. It's just how we spend it. And there's a special case where money needs to be spent more on Africa. So to summarise, Mr. Chairman, the actions required, we need the policies that enable this agricultural revolution to take place, that facilitate the development and adoption of new technologies. We need aligned and cohesive policies. If you make a decision about energy and we're going to mandate, you know, so much ethanol in our fuel consumption and don't think about what that does to land use on the farm and what that does to food production, then that's an example of an unaligned policy. So we need to be thinking through the whole system. We need much more investment in agriculture, research and development right along the value chain. It's just amazing that there was a tremendous thing. Hey, Australia is technically not in recession because, you know, we had a little bit of growth in the last quarter. What was the main source of that growth? Agricultural exports, you know, but didn't make a huge headline, did it? But the importance of investing in agriculture in relation to global food security is critical. And it's not going to be business as usual. I've had the privilege of working in agriculture for over 40 years. You know, I really believe it's the noblest profession. What else you work in that helps to feed people, helps to reduce poverty. It was said about the centre I worked at that a single gene, the dwarfing gene for wheat that made it high yielding, a single gene saved 100 million lives. So to me, this challenge of food security is a very noble one. It's a very necessary one. It's a tremendous challenge, but there are also some wonderful opportunities there. And we need investment in agriculture. We need the bright young brains putting their minds to solving this most fundamental and this most urgent of problems for the world. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tim. Highly authoritative and again, very sobering. Well, to mix the metaphors, colleagues and friends, are... Oh!
That was the collapse of the system. Can you just move across there a bit? That'd be happy talking about.
We'll try and straddle this.
Now you know why Tim is such a fantastic lecturer. He actually sort of has memorable moments. You okay there, Tim?
Snow said there was a fine line between the collapse and... That's right. I just found it.
Well, I hope you won't mind me saying that, to mix the metaphors, I was saying the food for thought in that those three presentations and a rich harvest of ideas, I think we see it there before us. And I'm grateful to our colleagues. They didn't leave us with problems. My medical associates, Roger Short and Fred Mendelson here, will know we can spend a lot of time in diagnosis, and we've got to get that right. But you don't stop there. You sort of start to sort of look at various therapies and try a few experiments in how to handle these wicked problems. So I'm very grateful to the panelists for raising it. Now, the chairman usually has the prerogative of asking the first question, but I think we only have 16 minutes of discussion time, and I know there's plenty there, and so I won't ask the first question at all. I'll simply ask whether the panel has any questions they would like of each other. Now, having heard each presentation where there might be some interpretation problem or issue which needs canvassing.
We'd like to hear what they
think. Good. Okay. Questions. 1, 2, 3, 4. Oh, we have a microphone. If you wouldn't mind passing it along, thank you.
Hello, thank you very much. I'm Rosemary Turner from Geelong. Professor Caroli this morning mentioned, I think, the biochar, and I was hoping that one of our speakers might be able to give us their opinion of whether that's promising at all.
Thank you. I think that we will start to see a lot of things bubbling to the surface as being the solution. I hope our panellists are not going to say there's such a thing as the solution. That's snow.
Is this work? Yes. So, there is a lot of interest in biochar. And it is a matter, I chair of the Department of Agriculture, Forestry, Fisheries Research Panel, which just funded a major project in biochar. There are two advantages that have been claimed for biochar. One is what we call an agronomic advantage, that Its presence in the soil may improve the quality of soil in a productivity sense. The second is a sequestration sense. And where we are at present, I think there are two big questions in this. I found a biochar. Is biochar, of course, it's taking organic material, whether it be waste or whether it be a tree, and pyrolyzing it, an act in itself that requires a lot of energy, and then putting that essentially charcoal away in the soil, and it'll stay there a long time. So there's no doubt that the charcoal will stay in the soil a long time. The real question in biochar for me is the amount of energy that you might spend preparing this biochar and distributing and incorporating it in the soil, is that actually going to end up with a net decrease in greenhouse gas emissions, or is it actually going to end up with a net increase in greenhouse gas emissions? Will you get any agronomic advantages? And in this biochar, just isn't biochar. There are different wastes that you use and there are different ways of pyrolyzing. So these are research questions we've got to deal with. And finally, in that, I think we need to ask the question of whether these wastes might be used in another way that would be more advantageous for the globe.
Tim.
Just add a couple of things to that. There are some quite innovative things that are happening now. People are also looking at feeding trials of biochar to ruminant animals with the possibility of reducing their methane emissions. And just sort of picking up a little bit of Snow's last point, I saw a proposal around some very innovative work where farmers might be looking at using biomass off the farm and turning it into ethanol amongst themselves, not to try to supply, you know, the fuel supply for Melbourne, but just for the on-farm use and the farm transport, which would be, and has some real possibilities, I think, and investing around, and the technology is already there. So that's another example of, you know, particularly maybe getting some production of something that's not suited for wheat production or dairy production, et cetera.
And that idea of localising, back to the old horse days, 10 to 15% of the farm used to be growing the oats for the horses, which then sort of did the rest of the productivity of the farm. I think a lot of research questions around biochar, you know, the solution, no. Research questions around to determine where it will find its place, yes. Thank you.
Angela, I'm from the University of Melbourne as well. And I had a question. It's that great truism, I think, of many people growing up of you have to finish your meal because there are starving children in Africa. And I wonder now with certainly in the developed world and certainly in Australia with increased levels of obesity and real problems with overconsumption, what relationship you see between these food security issues globally and a developed world that's kind of eating itself to death in some ways?
That's an extremely good question. One of the things is that if you've got more food, it doesn't necessarily mean that it will improve food security at the household level in some country in Africa or in Asia. But one of the things you can be sure of, if the world is short of food, the first people that go without are the poorest of the poor. So there's still a very sound argument for a larger pile of food. But just as someone said this morning that, you know, maybe this is the epoch of climate transition, but, you know, it's really broader than that. And I just believe that we have to have a transition in everything that we're doing. Anna Bly said for Queensland that on the current trends that they would be spending the whole of their government's budget on health by 2040 if we went on the same trend. So, you know, what we're doing at the moment in relation to health and nutrition and food is not sustainable. And so health from food in the Western world is going to become the key issue, which is going to mean it's going to be less, it's going to be more nutritious, it has to, there have to be, you know, safeguards there, there have to be ways of making that happen. We're starting to see that with labelling, we're starting to see that with healthy food programmes, etc. But it's going to be, food is going to be a source of health in two different ways, more and more nutritious in the developing world, less and more nutritious in the industrialised world.
Thank you. Yes, one, two. One at the back and then one, yes.
Hi, my name is Rachel. I'm from Melbourne University as well. I'd actually like to disagree with the last speaker. I had a question on obesity too, but it had a different tenor. Obviously, obesity is a leading cause of burden of disease in Australia, and that's often indirectly. I was going to go into that, but I won't. But the biggest thing is that, as sort of indicated by Barry Popkin and his associates, it's a global problem and it's largely occurring in the developing world. And there are kind of two major contributing factors to that. That firstly, obesity is very much associated with the kind of highly refined, shelf-stable, exportable foods that are really associated with big agribusiness, for want of a better term. So especially things like high-fructose corn syrup and products like that, which we find in virtually all of the food chain. And secondly, obesity really can be considered a form of malnutrition, and indeed a lot of obesity researchers argue that we should consider obesity a form of malnutrition. So if you look at the case of people who are living in conditions of chronic food insecurity, where the only foods they can get are the sort of very energy-dense, nutrition-poor foods which are very easy to produce, and you sort of have a recipe for global obesity. So you kind of have this condition now where you can say that obesity is the defining nutritional disease of our time. So my question was, with that kind of understanding of obesity, what role do you see for a reformed and sustainable agricultural system in addressing this kind of most central nutritional disease that we have right now?
Yeah. Janet.
Can I just offer a slightly different perspective on that? I think we would, a lot of the evidence is now showing obesity to be a disease of inequality in rich countries, and also a very rapid income growth in once poor countries. But particularly in a country like ours, and in the, and I think if you look at the work, say, of Richard Wilkinson, The Spirit Level, which has just come out, you can see the relationship between systemic inequality in societies and the way in which food is used as a means of coping with the distress of inequality. Secondly, the thing which has really changed has been the growth of big business, particularly chains like McDonald's. And I think we've got to revisit the sorts of debates that were occurring in the second half of the 19th century, which is when the state really started to take on the power over individual freedom in relation to public health. We accept an extraordinary degree of intrusion of the state into our private lives, even into our families, in the interests of protecting us from disease. We don't even think about the state as having this enormous amount of power over us. Now we're confronted with climate change, which is another area where, again, perhaps that's got to happen, but also that we've now got to start thinking collectively that in the end the solution to things like obesity are going to be collective solutions which both regulate what food is we buy but also start addressing the very deep problems of inequality and the sort of distress that causes.
Thank you, Dan. Yes, I think just on that also, I think it was Tim who was saying what an incredible challenge we have in the agri-food space and a fantastic opportunity. It must be attractive to the brightest and best who want to contribute to a global issue, sort of, in the students. And we see numbers in sort of this field decreasing. But the other attraction, I think, which Victoria is particularly well placed, is combining that agri-food sector, which sort of is doing pretty well, sort of as Tim was also saying in Australia, with that medical research fraternity, particularly in Melbourne. You know, isn't that a fantastic opportunity for Victoria? Bring the agri-food with the biomedical and start addressing these macro issues which start on the farm and finish up in the clinic public health. Beautiful opportunity for Victoria. Food for life. One, and then in front.
G'day, Ian Allen. Question for Tim. You were talking about minimum till and all these sort of different approaches to agriculture to make them more productive. So many places are marginal as it is, and with climate change going to become even more marginal. In the absence of genetically engineered sort of crops and so forth. How are we going to increase the productivity? And I see also another layer of issues on that. As these areas become marginal and we have certain sorts of expertise in particular areas for like growing wheat or dairy farming or whatever, these dairy farming areas and different types of cropping areas are going to shift. How are we going to cope in the context of these changing climates and changing regions where these activities will have to occur? How are we going to cope with the expertise, transfer of expertise issues? So, you know, the productivity issue and the transfer of expertise issue. Comment, please.
An excellent question. I wish that I knew all of the answers to it. But I think it's one of the issues that hasn't been adequately addressed yet as we've looked at adaptation to climate change. And if you looked, for example, if we took the Australian example, you could say, well, nationally, maybe grain production nationally will not go down in Australia, you know, under a significant climate change regime. But it will change its geographical location about where it happens. It won't be in the, you know, the currently 300 millimetre rainfall country. It'll be currently in the, it'll be in the currently 700 or 800 millimetre rainfall country. And one can think about that. Well, nationally, nothing happened. Socially, structurally, infrastructurally, that's enormous. And we haven't really thought about those. So a key part of adaptation to climate change is to have the participation of the communities that are going to be affected in that process. At the moment, we're sort of at the awareness level and a little bit of that, but the reality is we're going to need a lot much more education, communication and participation to start to grapple with those issues. Productivity, I'll just say relatively, that what we're already seeing is that, for example, in some areas where people used to crop, they've now gone to livestock and that's more sustainable for them. It's not such a huge shock, that move, but it's going to be about matching the capacity of the environment with the agricultural capacity much better than we've done it in the past. I think we can do that.
Very briefly, Snow.
Just an addendum on that in relation to irrigated agriculture. Tim mentioned dryland. That problem is there in spades. If we end up having something that might be half the amount of irrigation water in our irrigation areas, which could happen, how do we meter that water out? Because those communities have very large multipliers on the farm production. It's basically about 4 to 1. For every farm job, there is 4 jobs elsewhere that hangs on those industries. So those industries, those communities around irrigation areas, we really have to think very seriously about what we're going to do with those. We don't have solutions yet, but there are some issues there that we're going to have to deal with.
Huge political problems. Now, I think there was definitely this in front here. Yes? And I think that, colleagues, we'll there is one, maybe if it's short, we'll have the last question right up in the corner, and that will then we'll have to wrap up, I'm sorry.
My name is Helen Hill. I come from Glen Waverley. I go to my Baker's Delight shop in the Glen at about 5:15, just before closing time, and there's a full range of breads. And then a little while later, the place closes. I see that as a huge amount of waste. How do we combat that? Another, just a brief point, is there any thought about encouraging people in the most of the world who eat white rice to shift to brown rice?
Okay, the first question of how we become less wasteful and more mindful of, and again, that practice change. This is a technological fix for some issues, but something like that, that first part of the question is a practice change, is it not?
Tim. Yeah, I think it's part of this transition. I mean, the reality is that people, you know, there have been some complaints about food costs, but really we don't pay the full cost of food. We just pay the transaction costs around the inputs and the labour on the farmer's side, but we don't pay the environmental cost. We don't pay for the environmental value of the water that's used. We don't pay for the soil fertility that's locked up in there. And so when you're in that sort of scenario, you know, we need 100, well, why don't we produce 150 and we'll chuck the rest away? If we start paying the real costs of food, then you'll see that the market will start to work on there. In the short term, I was very happy to hear a social program where a lot of the bakeries and other things donate their food and it goes to feed the homeless. But in the longer term, it's about getting real. It's, you know, it's like the financial situation is like our use of energy. We've just totally overused it.
Well, I think, I'm sorry, colleagues, but Patrick is starting to look at me questioningly. I will have to draw things to a conclusion. I'm sure our panellists will be about mingling as we get to clean out the room for the next session. And so you can continue that conversation. I'd just, on your behalf, like to thank the panellists most sincerely. And to yourselves for, firstly, attendance, and then participation.